Emergence. When Erica was in eighth grade, not in the New Hope school, but in an old-fashioned public school, two young Teach for America alumni started a new charter high school nearby called simply the Academy. It was meant to pick up the kids who graduated from New Hope, and it had a similar ethos, with uniforms, discipline, and special programs. The founders had started out with a theory about poverty. They didn't know what caused it. They figured it arose from some mixture of the loss of manufacturing jobs, racial discrimination, globalization, cultural transmission, bad luck, bad government policies, and a thousand other factors. But they did have a few useful observations. They didn't think anybody else knew what caused poverty either. They believed that it was futile to try to find one lever to lift kids out of poverty because there was no one cause for it. They believed if you wanted to tackle the intergenerational cycle of poverty, you had to do everything at once. When they first conceived of the Academy, they worked up a presentation for donors, which they later discarded because almost none of the donors understood it. But the premise behind the presentation was still dear to their hearts. The premise was that poverty is an emergent system. Through most of human history, people have tried to understand their world through reductive reasoning. That is to say, they have been inclined to take things apart to see how they work. As Albert Laszlo Barabasi wrote in his influential book, Linked, reductionism was the driving force behind much of the 20th century's scientific research. To comprehend nature, it tells us, we must decipher its components. The assumption is that once we understand the parts, it will be easy to grasp the whole. Divide and conquer. The devil is in the details. Therefore, for decades, we have been forced to see the world through its constituents. We have been trained to study atoms and superstrings to understand the universe, molecules to comprehend life, individual genes to understand complex behavior, prophets to see the origin of fads and religions. This way of thinking induces people to think they can understand a problem by dissecting it into its various parts. They can understand a person's personality if they just tease out and investigate his genetic or environmental traits. This deductive mode is the specialty of conscious cognition, the sort of cognition that is linear and logical. The problem with this approach is that it has trouble explaining dynamic complexity, the essential feature of a human being, a culture, or a society. So recently there has been a greater appreciation for the structure of emergent systems. Emergent systems exist when different elements come together and produce something that is greater than the sum of their parts. Or, to put it differently, the pieces of a system interact, and out of their interaction, something entirely new emerges. For example, benign things like air and water come together, and sometimes, through a certain pattern of interaction, a hurricane emerges. Sounds and syllables come together and produce a story that has an emotional power that is irreducible to its constituent parts. Emergent systems don't rely upon a central controller. Instead, once a pattern of interaction is established, it has a downward influence on the behavior of the components. For example, let's say an ant in a colony stumbles upon a new food source. No dictator ant has to tell the colony to reorganize itself to harvest that source. Instead, one ant, in the course of his normal foraging, stumbles upon the food. Then a neighboring ant will notice that ant's change in direction, and then a neighbor of that ant will notice the change, and pretty soon, as Stephen Johnson puts it, local information can lead to global wisdom. The entire colony will have a pheromone superhighway to harvest the new food source. A change has been quickly communicated through the system, and the whole colony mind has restructured itself to take advantage of this new circumstance. There has been no conscious decision to make the change. But a new set of arrangements has emerged, and once the custom has been set, future ants will automatically conform. Emergent systems are really good at passing down customs across hundreds or thousands of generations. As Deborah Gordon of Stanford discovered, if you put ants in a large plastic tray, they will build a colony. They will also build a cemetery for dead ants, and the cemetery will be as far as possible from the colony. They will also build a garbage dump, which will be as far as possible from both the colony and the cemetery. No individual ant worked out the geometry. In fact, each individual ant may be blind to the entire structure. Instead, individual ants followed local cues. Other ants adjusted to the cues of a few ants, and pretty soon the whole colony had established a precedent of behavior. Once this precedent has been established, thousands of generations can be born, and the wisdom will endure. Once established, the precedents exert their own downward force. There are emergent systems all around. The brain is an emergent system. An individual neuron in the brain does not contain an idea, say, of an apple. But out of the pattern of firing of millions of neurons, the idea of an apple emerges. Genetic transmission is an emergent system. Out of the complex interaction of many different genes and many different environments, certain traits, such as aggressiveness, might emerge. A marriage is an emergent system. Francine Klagsbrunn has observed that when a couple comes in for marriage therapy, there are three patients in the room: the husband, the wife, and the marriage itself. The marriage is the living history of all the things that have happened between husband and wife. Once the precedents are set and have permeated both brains, the marriage itself begins to shape their individual behavior. Though it exists in the space between them, it has an influence all its own. Cultures are emergent systems. There is no one person who embodies the traits of American or French or Chinese culture. There is no dictator determining the patterns of behavior that make up the culture. But out of the actions and relationships of millions of individuals, certain regularities do emerge. Once those habits arise, then future individuals adopt them unconsciously. Poverty, the two academy founders believed, is an emergent system too. The people who live in deep poverty are enmeshed in complex ecosystems no one can fully see and understand. In 2003, Eric Turkheimer of the University of Virginia published a study that showed that growing up in poverty can lead to a lower IQ. Journalists naturally asked him, "What can be done to boost IQ development in poor children?" The honest answer to the question is that I don't think there is anything in particular about the environment that is responsible for the effects of poverty, he wrote later. I don't think there is any single thing in an impoverished environment that is responsible for the deleterious effects of poverty. Turkheimer had spent years trying to find which parts of growing up with a poor background produced the most negative results. He could easily show the total results of poverty, but when he tried to measure the impact of specific variables, he found there was nothing there. He conducted a meta-analysis of 43 studies that scrutinized which specific elements of a child's background most powerfully shaped cognitive deficiencies. The studies failed to demonstrate the power of any specific variable, even though the total effect of all the variables put together was very clear. That doesn't mean you do nothing to alleviate the effects of poverty. It means you don't try to break down those effects into constituent parts. It's the total emergent system that has its effects. As Turkheimer notes, no complex behaviors in free-ranging humans are caused by a linear and additive set of causes. Any important outcome, like adolescent delinquent behavior, has a myriad of interrelated causes, and each of these causes has a myriad of potential effects, inducing a squared myriad of environmental complexity even before one gets to the certainty that the environmental effects co-determine each other, or that the package interacts with the just as myriad effects of genes. For scientists, this circumstance leads to what Turkheimer calls the gloomy prospect. There is no way to pin down and clarify the causes of human behavior or trace the sources of this or that behavior. It is possible to show how emergent conditions, like poverty or single parenthood, can roughly affect big groups. It is, of course, possible to show correlations between one thing and another, and those correlations are valuable. But it is hard or impossible to show how A causes B. Causation is obscured in the darkness of the gloomy prospect. For the founders of the Academy, the lesson was, fixate on whole cultures, not specific pieces of poverty. No specific intervention is going to turn around the life of a child or an adult in any consistent way. But if you can surround a person with a new culture, a different web of relationships, then they will absorb new habits of thought and behaviors in ways you will never be able to measure or understand. And if you do surround that person with a new, enriching culture, then you had better keep surrounding them with it, because if they slip back into a different culture, then most of the gains will fade away. The founders figured they would start not just a school, but a counterculture. Their school would be an immersive environment that would give lower-class kids access to an achievement ethos. It couldn't be totally hostile to the culture in which they lived, or else they would just reject it. But it would insist on the sort of norms, habits, and messages that had allowed the founders, sons of doctors and lawyers, to go to college. Their school would bluntly acknowledge that we live in an unequal and polarized society. It would declare forthrightly that poor kids need different sorts of institutional support than middle-class kids. Their school would be parent-neutral, which was a polite way of saying they would blot out the culture the poor kids' parents were unconsciously handing down. The sociologist James Coleman had once found that parents and community have a greater effect on achievement than school. The founders of the Academy decided that their school would not just be a bunch of classrooms where math and English were taught. It would also be a neighborhood and a family. The school the pair envisioned would train kids to see childhood as a ladder to college, a ladder out. The difficult thing about emergence is that it is very hard in emergent systems to find the root cause of any problem. The positive side is that if you have negative cascades producing bad outcomes, it is also possible to have positive cascades producing good ones. Once you have a positive set of cultural cues, you can get a happy avalanche as productive influences feed on and reinforce one another. There was no way Erica was not going to be in this school. By the time she was in eighth grade, Erica had grown taller and prettier, but no less stubborn. Some deep dissatisfaction had crept into her blood. She screamed at her mother and loved her fiercely, a tangle too complex for anybody to understand. On the streets with her peers, she argued, overreacted, and sometimes fought. At school, she was both an excellent student and a problem. Somehow, it had gotten into her head that life is a battle, and she lived on a warlike footing, antagonizing people for no good reason. She was sometimes a bitch to people who were trying to help her. She knew she was being a bitch, and she knew it was wrong, but she didn't stop. When she looked in the mirror, her motto was, "I am strong." She persuaded herself she hated her school, which she didn't. She persuaded herself she hated her neighborhood, which she sort of did. Here was her true genius. She somehow understood she couldn't change herself on her own. She couldn't remain in her current environment and just turn her prospects around by force of individual willpower. She would always be subject to the same emotional cues. They would overpower conscious intention. But she could make one decision, to change her environment. And if she could change her environment, she would be subject to a whole different set of cues and unconscious cultural influences. It's easier to change your environment than to change your insides. Change your environment, and then let the new cues do the work. She spent the first part of eighth grade learning about the Academy, talking to students, asking her mother, and quizzing her teachers. One day in February, she heard that the board of the school had arrived for a meeting, and she decided in her own junior warrior manner that she'd demand that they let her in. She snuck into the school when a group of kids came out the back door for gym class, and she made her way to the conference room. She knocked and entered the room. There was a group of tables pushed toward the middle of the room, with about 25 adults sitting around the outside of them. The two academy founders were sitting in the middle on the far side of the tables. "I would like to come to your school," she said, loud enough for the whole room to hear. "How did you get in here?" somebody at the table barked. "May I please come to your school next year?" One of the founders smiled. "You see, we have a lottery system. If you enter your name, there is a drawing in April." "I would like to come to your school," Erica interrupted, launching into the speech she had rehearsed in her head for months. "I tried to get into New Hope when I was 10, and they wouldn't let me. I went down to the agency and I told the lady, but she wouldn't let me. It took them 3 cops to get me out of there, but I'm 13 now and I've worked hard. I get good grades. I know appropriate behavior. I feel I deserve to go to your school. You can ask anyone. I have references." She held out a piece of binder paper with her teacher's names on it. "What's your name?" the founder asked. "Erica." "You see, we have rules about this. Many people would like to come to the academy, so we decided the fairest thing to do is to have a lottery each spring." "That's just a way of saying no." "You'll have as fair a chance as anyone." "That's just a way of saying no. I need to go to the academy. I need to go to college." Erica had nothing more to say. She just stood there, silently. She decided it would take some more cops to take her away. Sitting across from the founders was a great fat man. He was a hedge fund manager who had made billions of dollars and largely funded the school. He was brilliant, but had the social graces of a gnat. He took a pen from his pocket and wrote something on a piece of paper. He looked at Erica one more time, folded the paper, and slid it across the table to the founders. They opened it up and read the note. It said, "Rig the fucking lottery." The founders were silent for a moment and looked at each other. Finally, one of them looked up and said in a low voice, "What did you say your name was?"
"Erica."
"Listen, Erica. At the academy, we have rules. We have one set of rules for everybody. Those rules we follow to the letter. We demand discipline, total discipline. So I'm only going to say this to you once. If you ever tell anybody about bursting in here and talking to us like that, I will personally kick you out of our school." "Are we clear about that?"
"Yes, sir."
"Then write your name and address on a piece of paper. Put it on the table, and I will see you in September." The fat man heaved himself up out of his chair and handed Erica his pen and a little pad. She had never seen a pen like that, except on TV. She wrote out her name and address and her social security number, just to make sure, and she left. When she was gone, the members of the board just looked at one another. Then, after a few seconds, everybody was sure she was out of earshot. The hedge fund guy broke out into a grin. The room erupted in a wave of joyful laughter. Chapter 8. Self-Control. The academy certainly was a shock for Erica. In the first place, it went on forever. School at the academy lasted from 8 in the morning until 5 in the evening. Erica also had to go on Saturday and for several weeks over the summer. Students who were performing below grade level spent twice as much time in school as other American students, and even students performing at grade level spent 50% more time there. Second, the school provided everything. There were the usual English and math classes. Actually, she took two separate English classes every day. But there was also a health clinic, psychological counseling, full meal services, and evening activities. But the biggest shock was the emphasis on behavior. The academy started from the ground up. It taught its students to look at someone who was talking to them, how to sit up in class, how to nod to signal agreement, how to shake hands and say hello on first meeting. Erica and her classmates spent the entire first session of her music class learning how to file into the room and take their seats. During the first weeks of school, they were taught how to walk down the hall, how to carry their books, how to say, "Excuse me," if they bumped into one another. The teachers told them that, if they did the small stuff right, the big stuff would be much easier to master later on. Middle-class kids may have learned these lessons automatically, but many of the kids at the academy had to be taught. Another big shock was the chanting. Every school day began with what they called school-wide circle time. Every student gathered in the gym and they performed raps and chants together. They had a respect chant. They had a knowledge is power call and response. They had a college chant in which they screamed out the names of prominent universities and vowed to make it to one of them. At the end of each rally, a gym teacher asked them the questions. Why are you here? To get an education. How do you get it? Hard work. What do you do? Work hard. What do you use? Self-discipline. Where are you going? College. Why? To be master of my own destiny. How are you going to get there? Earn it. What is earned? Everything is earned. Each class had its own graduation date. But the year was not the year they would graduate from the academy. It was the year they would graduate from college 4 years later. Each classroom had an identity, but it was not room 215 or room 111. It was the name of the college the teacher who taught in it had attended: Michigan, Claremont, Indiana, or Wellesley. College was the promised land. College was the elevated circle these students would someday join. In class, Erica learned about things she had never even heard about: life in Thailand and ancient Babylon. She was tested and assessed every 6 weeks, and the tests were used to mark her progress. If she surpassed expectations, she earned scholar dollars, with which she could buy privileges like free time and field trips. Her favorite class was orchestra, where she was taught to read music and started to play the Brandenburg Concerto. She made the honor roll her second term, which meant she could wear a blue shirt to school instead of the white ones that were the standard uniform. Putting on that shirt for the first time, at an assembly in front of the whole school, was the single proudest event of her life up until that moment. After school, she played tennis. Erica had never played an organized sport before. She had never so much as picked up a racket. But a few years earlier, two African-American tennis stars had come to the school and donated money to build four tennis courts out back. A coach came in every day to teach the game. Erica decided she wanted to be on the team. Erica became a much more serious student at the academy, but there was something ferocious about the way she took up tennis. She became obsessed by it. She spent hours every afternoon pounding a ball against the wall. She put tennis posters on the walls of her room at home. She learned the geography of the world by learning about where tennis stars were born and where the tournaments were held. During freshman and sophomore years, in particular, she organized her life around the little yellow ball. Tennis was serving some larger cosmic purpose in her mind. Walter Lippmann once wrote that, "Above all the other necessities of human nature, above the satisfaction of any other need, above hunger, love, pleasure, fame, even life itself. What a man most needs is the conviction that he is contained within the discipline of an ordered existence. For a few years, tennis organized Erica's identity. Erica was strong and fast, and though she never admitted it to anyone, she became convinced, even for just these 2 years, that tennis could be her path to fortune and fame. She saw herself at Wimbledon. She saw herself at the French Open. She saw herself back at the school telling future students how it had all begun. Her email address was tennisgirl1. Her online passwords had to do with tennis. The doodles on her notebooks were about tennis. Day after day, she picked up tips from the coach, read the online tennis sites, and watched tennis on TV. And day after day, her tennis improved. But there was an anger in her game that scared everyone around her. She was a determined and somewhat serious person in most of the realms of her life, but not an angry one. On the court, she was driven by impatience for everyone and everything. She never talked on the court or bantered with her partners. When she was winning, people relaxed around her, but when she was losing, they kept out of her way. If she had a bad practice session on the court, it ruined the rest of her day, and she went home foul and cranky. At first, the coach called her Little Mac, since her attitude was like John McEnroe's. But one day, it got scary. It was the spring of her sophomore year, and her team was playing at an upper-middle-class school in the suburbs. By this point, Erica was the second-ranked girl on the team, playing a singles match late in the afternoon. Her coach watched her first service game from behind the fence and had a sinking sensation right away. Her first serve went long. Her second serve hit the bottom of the net. By the time she was down 3-0, her form was in disarray. On volleys, her shoulder was flying open. On serves, her arm was dipping down, and she was practically serving sidearm, blasting the ball anywhere but into the other court. Her coach told her to count to 10, relax, and regain her composure. But she looked at him like a feral animal, her brows furrowed with rage and frustration. Soon she was standing flat-footed awaiting the serve, paying more attention to her own frustration than to the ball. Her returns hit the net, went long or wide, and after each one she'd bark, "Fuck!" to herself. The coach started peppering her with advice. Keep your shoulder in. Move your feet. Work on your toss. Rush the net. But she was stuck in some spiral of disorganization. She hit the ball as hard as possible, and each error seemed to vindicate some tide of self-hatred rising inside. For reasons that would never be clear, she began sabotaging her own game, hitting volleys deep into the fence behind the court, not even trying to return serves she could have made a try at. She stomped off the court during side changes and threw her racket on the ground beneath her chair. After one bad volley, she wheeled and threw her racket against the fence. Her coach lit into her. "Erica, grow up or get out." Erica hit the next serve for an ace and glared at him. Her next serve was in, but was called out. "Are you fucking crazy?" Erica screamed. All games stopped. Erica slammed her racket to the ground. "Are you fucking crazy?" She stormed the net and looked like she was going to throttle anybody who got in her way. Her opponent, the line judge, her teammates, everybody physically recoiled. She was overflowing with steam and fury. She knew at that very moment she was doing wrong. But it felt so good. She wanted to punch someone and see a face explode in a flash of blood. She felt some surge of power and domination as she looked at the people drawing back nervously around her. She was looking for somebody to humiliate. For several long seconds, nobody approached. Eventually, she stormed off the court and sat in her chair looking down. She blamed everybody but herself. The assholes of the world, the ball, the racket, her opponent. Finally, her coach came over, as furious as she was. He grabbed her arm and barked, "You're out of here. Let's go." She yanked it away. "Don't you fucking touch me!" But she got up and started walking toward the bus, 3 strides ahead of him. She slammed her fist against the metal side of the bus as she stepped on and stomped on down the aisle. She threw her gear against the wall and herself onto the back bench. She sat there for 1.5 hours, while the rest of the matches finished, and then stewed silently as they all rode back to school. There was no reaching her that afternoon. She had no remorse. No fear of getting into trouble at the academy or at home. She was stubborn, unyielding, and harsh when anybody tried to talk with her. By the time the team got back to school, everybody was talking about how Erica had gone crazy on the court. The next day they stopped the school, which is what the administrators did when something terrible had happened. Classes were canceled, and every student and teacher gathered for 1 hour in the gym for an assembly on sportsmanship. They never mentioned Erica's name, but everybody knew she had caused it. Teachers and administrators pulled her aside that day, some harsh, some soft, but none of what they said registered. Temperament. By the next evening, though, the whole episode was beginning to look different. Erica cried into her pillow. She felt a wave of humiliation and shame. By this age, her mother, Amy, was no match for Erica. Her personality wasn't as strong. But she knew what it was like to behave in ways that were inexplicable to yourself. She wondered if she'd simply passed these genes on to her daughter, and all Erica's fine qualities were about to be overshadowed by the dark ones inherited from dear old Mom. She also wondered if these were just the storms of Erica's adolescence, or whether this would be her life now and forever. All human beings have inherited from the distant past an automatic ability to respond to surprises and stress, the so-called fight-or-flight response. Some people, even from the earliest age, seem to flee from stress and pain. Some, like Erica, fight. Some newborns startle more easily than others. Their heart rate shoots up more than others when confronted with strange situations, and their blood pressure rises. Their bodies react more vividly. In 1979, psychologist Jerome Kagan and his colleagues presented 500 infants with a series of unfamiliar stimuli. About 20% of the babies cried vigorously and were labeled high reactive. Another 40% showed little response and were labeled low reactive. The rest were in between. A decade or so later, Kagan ran the same children through a battery of experiences that were designed to induce performance anxiety. About 1/5 of those who had been labeled high reactive still responded sharply to stress. 1/3 of the low reactives still maintained their sense of calm. Most of the kids had matured and were now in the middle range. Very few of the kids had jumped from the high reactive to low reactive, or vice versa. In other words, kids are born with a certain temperament. That temperament is not a track that will guide them through life. It is, as E.O. Wilson has argued, a leash. Erica, like all kids, was born with a certain disposition, whether to be high-strung or preternaturally calm, whether to be naturally sunny or naturally morose. Her disposition would evolve over the course of her life, depending on how experience wired her brain, but the range of this evolution would have limits. She might grow from high-strung to moderately tempered, but her personality would probably not flip from one extreme to another. And once that basic home state was established, her moods would oscillate around that mean. She might win the lottery and be delighted for a few weeks, but after a time she would return to that home state, and her life would be no happier than if she'd never won it. On the other hand, she might lose a husband or a friend, but she would, after some period of grief and agony, return to that home state. Amy was worried. Erica had some dangerous fire inside. Even early on, it was clear that Erica's moods oscillated more wildly than most. She seemed to startle intensely when something unexpected happened. People who startle easily experience more anxiety and dread through life. Some researchers distinguished between dandelion children and orchid children. Dandelion kids are more even-tempered and hardier. They'll do pretty well wherever you put them. Orchid children are more variable. They can bloom spectacularly in the right setting or wither pitifully in the wrong one. Erica was an orchid, perched dangerously between success and catastrophe. As Amy sat there, wondering blankly about Erica's future, she was experiencing that pervasive depth of worry that the parents of adolescents all know. She herself had been one of those kids who became overly defensive at the first sign of perceived frustration, who misinterpret normal situations as menacing ones, who perceive anger when it isn't there, feel slights that aren't intended, who are victim to an imagined inner world, which is more dangerous than the outer world they actually inhabit. People who live with that sort of chronic stress suffer cell loss in their hippocampus, and with it loss of memory, especially the memory of good things that have happened to them. Their immune systems weaken. They have fewer minerals in their bones. They accumulate body fat more easily, especially around the middle. They live with long-term debilitating deficits. A study of engineers who worked up to 90 hours a week for 6 months on an extremely stressful project had higher levels of cortisol and epinephrine, two chemicals associated with stress, for up to 18 months later, even though all of them had taken 4 to 5 week vacations after the project was over. The effects of stress can be long-lasting and corrosive. That night, a full 30 hours after the tennis meltdown, Amy still wasn't sure how much she could ease her daughter's stress and shame. So she just sat there with her hand on Erica's back and rather pitifully helped her cope. After about 15 minutes, they were both a little restless and they got up and started making dinner. Erica made a salad. Amy got the pasta out from the pantry. She and Erica were doing something together. They were doing something that calmed their minds and restored their equilibrium. Somehow, Erica was seeing the world calmly again. At one point, while she was slicing tomatoes, Erica looked up and asked her, "Why am I a person I can't control?" This was actually quite an important question. Research by Angela Duckworth and Martin Seligman found that self-control is twice as important as IQ in predicting high school performance, school attendance, and final grades. Other researchers disagree that self-control trumps IQ, but there is no question self-control is one of the essential ingredients of a fulfilling life. "It feels like it wasn't even me," Erica told her mother during one of their conversations about the event. "It was like it was some strange, angry person who had hijacked my body. I don't understand where this person came from or what she was thinking. I'm afraid she's going to come back again and do something terrible."
The famous marshmallow. Around 1970, Walter Mischel, then at Stanford and now at Columbia, launched one of the most famous and delightful experiments in modern psychology. He sat a series of four-year-olds in a room and put a marshmallow on the table. He told them they could eat the marshmallow right away, but that he was going to go away, and if they waited until he returned, he would give them two marshmallows. In the videos of the experiment, you can see Mischel leave the room, and then the children squirming, kicking, hiding their eyes and banging their heads on the table, trying not to eat the marshmallow on the table in front of them. One day, Mischel used an Oreo instead of a marshmallow. A kid picked up the cookie, slyly ate the creamy filling, and carefully put it back in its place. That kid is probably now a U.S. senator. But the significant thing is this. The kids who could wait several minutes subsequently did much better in school and had fewer behavioral problems than the kids who could wait only a few minutes. They had better social skills in middle school. The kids who could wait a full 15 minutes had, 13 years later, SAT scores that were 210 points higher than the kids who could wait only 30 seconds. The marshmallow test turned out to be a better predictor of SAT scores than the IQ tests given to four-year-olds. 20 years later, they had much higher college completion rates, and 30 years later, they had much higher incomes. The kids who could not wait at all had much higher incarceration rates. They were much more likely to suffer from drug and alcohol addiction problems. The test presented kids with a conflict between short-term impulse and long-term reward. The marshmallow test measured whether kids had learned strategies to control their impulses. The ones who learned to do that did well in school and life. Those that hadn't found school endlessly frustrating. The kids who possessed these impulse control abilities had usually grown up in organized homes. In their upbringing, actions had led to predictable consequences. They possessed a certain level of self-confidence, the assumption that they could succeed at what they set out to do. Kids who could not resist the marshmallows often came from disorganized homes. They were less likely to see the link between actions and consequences, and less likely to have learned strategies to help them master immediate temptations. But the crucial finding concerned the nature of the strategies that worked. The kids who did poorly directed their attention right at the marshmallow. They thought if they looked right at it, they could somehow master their temptation to eat it. The ones who could wait distracted themselves from the marshmallow. They pretended it wasn't real, it wasn't there, or it wasn't really a marshmallow. They had techniques to adjust their attention. In later experiments, Michel told the children to put a mental frame around the marshmallow, to imagine that what they were seeing was a picture of a marshmallow. These children could wait on average 3 times longer than the children who did not imagine a picture. Children who were told to imagine the marshmallow was a fluffy cloud could also wait much longer. By using their imagination, they encoded their perceptions of the marshmallow differently. They distanced themselves from it and triggered different, less impulsive models in their heads. The children who could control their impulses triggered cool ways of perceiving the marshmallow. The children who could not triggered hot ways. They could see it only as the delicious temptation it really was. Once those in the latter group engaged these hot networks in their brain, it was all over. There was no way they were not going to pop the marshmallow into their mouths. The implication of the marshmallow experiment is that self-control is not really about iron willpower mastering the hidden passions. The conscious mind simply lacks the strength and awareness to directly control unconscious processes. Instead, it's about triggering. At any moment, there are many different operations running, or capable of running, at an unconscious level. People with self-control and self-discipline develop habits and strategies that trigger the unconscious processes that enable them to perceive the world in productive and far-seeing ways. Character reconsidered. Human decision-making has 3 basic steps. First, we perceive a situation. Second, we use the power of reason to calculate whether taking this or that action is in our long-term interest. Third, we use the power of will to execute our decision. Over the centuries, different theories of character have emerged, and along with them, different ways of instilling character in the young. In the 19th century, most character-building models focused on step 3 of the decision-making process, willpower. Victorian moralists had an almost hydraulic conception of proper behavior. The passions are a wild torrent, and upstanding people use the iron force of will to dam it, repress it, and control it. In the 20th century, most character-building models focused on step 2 of the decision-making process, the use of reason to calculate interests. 20th century moralists emphasized consciousness-raising techniques to remind people of the long-term risks of bad behavior. They reminded people that unsafe sex leads to disease, unwanted pregnancy, and other bad outcomes. Smoking can lead to cancer. Adultery destroys families, and lying destroys trust. The assumption was that, once you reminded people of the foolishness of their behavior, they would be motivated to stop. Both reason and will are obviously important in making moral decisions and exercising self-control. But neither of these character models has proven very effective. You can tell people not to eat the French fry. You can give them pamphlets about the risks of obesity. You can deliver sermons urging them to exercise self-control and not eat the fry. And in their non-hungry state, most people will vow not to eat it. But when their hungry self rises, their well-intentioned self fades, and they eat the French fry. Most diets fail because the conscious forces of reason and will are simply not powerful enough to consistently subdue unconscious urges. And if that is true of eating a fry, it is also true of more consequential things. Preachers issue jeremiads against the evils of adultery, but this seems to have no effect on the number of people in the flock who commit the act, or on the number of preachers themselves who do it. Thousands of books have been written about the sin of greed, but every few years greed runs self-destructively rampant. There is near universal agreement that spending on material things doesn't produce joy and fulfillment, and yet millions of people run up huge credit card debt. Everyone knows killing is wrong, and yet genocide happens. Terrorists convince themselves it is righteous to murder the innocent. For decades, people have tried to give drug users information about the dangers of addiction, teenagers information on the risks involved in unprotected sex, students about the negative consequences of dropping out of school. And yet the research is clear. Information programs alone are not very effective in changing behavior. For example, a 2001 survey of over 300 sex education programs found that, in general, these programs had no effect on sexual behavior or contraceptive use. Classroom teaching or seminar consciousness raising has little direct effect on unconscious impulses. Sermons don't help either. The evidence suggests reason and will are like muscles, and not particularly powerful muscles. In some cases, and in the right circumstances, they can resist temptation and control the impulses, but in many cases they are simply too weak to impose self-discipline by themselves. In many cases, self-delusion takes control. The 19th and 20th century character-building models were limited because they shared one assumption: that step one in the decision-making process, the act of perception, is a relatively simple matter of taking in a scene. The real action involved the calculation about what to do and the willpower necessary to actually do it. But, as should be clear by now, that's wrong. The first step is actually the most important one. Perceiving isn't just a transparent way of taking in, it is a thinking and skillful process. Seeing and evaluating are not two separate processes. They are linked and basically simultaneous. The research of the past 30 years suggests that some people have taught themselves to perceive more skillfully than others. The person with good character has taught herself, or been taught by those around her, to see situations in the right way. When she sees something in the right way, she's rigged the game. She's triggered a whole network of unconscious judgments and responses in her mind, biasing her to act in a certain manner. Once the game has been rigged, then reason and will have a much easier time. They will be up to the task of guiding proper behavior. For example, some students walk into a classroom with no innate respect for whatever teacher they may find there. When they get angry or frustrated, they'll curse at the teacher, ignore him, humiliate him, or even punch or throw a chair at him. Other students, on the other hand, do walk into the room with an innate respect for the teacher. They know, without thinking about it, that they are supposed to defer to him, that there are certain ways you act in front of a teacher and certain ways you don't. They may get angry or annoyed, but they will express those feelings out of class. It would never occur to them to scream, curse, or throw a chair at a teacher. If someone were to do it in their presence, they'd gasp with shock and horror. Where did that innate respect come from? How did it come to be that the mere act of seeing the teacher triggered certain parameters in their minds? The answers are lost in gloomy prospect. The answers are lost in the midnight river of the unconscious. But somehow, over the course of their lives, they have had certain experiences. Maybe they came to respect the authority of their parents and now extend that mental frame to authority figures in general. Maybe they have absorbed certain stories in which they observed people treating teachers in a certain way. Maybe they have absorbed certain small habits and norms about classroom behavior that put a leash on the sort of behavior they consider unacceptable there. Out of these myriad influences, a certain pattern of perception has emerged, a certain way of seeing. Having learned to see a teacher in a certain way, they would never even consider punching one in the face, except in the realm of faraway fantasy, which they know they will never enact. Similarly, upright people learn to see other people's property in a way that reduces the temptation to steal. They learn to see a gun in a way that reduces their temptation to misuse it. They learn to see young girls in a way that reduces the temptation to abuse them. They learn to see truth in a way that reduces the temptation to lie. This learning to see model emphasizes that it is not one crucial moment that shapes a character. Character emerges gradually out of the mysterious interplay of a million little good influences. This model emphasizes the power of community to shape character. It's very hard to build self-control alone. And if you're in a community of obese people, it's very hard to stay thin alone. It also emphasizes the power of small and repetitive action to rewire the fundamental mechanisms of the brain. Small habits and proper etiquette reinforce certain positive ways of seeing the world. Good behavior strengthens certain networks. Aristotle was right when he observed, "We acquire virtues by first having put them into action." The folks at Alcoholics Anonymous put the sentiment more practically with their slogan, "Fake it until you make it." Timothy Wilson of the University of Virginia puts it more scientifically. "One of the most enduring lessons of social psychology is that behavior change often precedes changes in attitude and feelings." Rematch. People looked at Erica strangely in the days and weeks after the explosion. Erica looked at herself strangely. But months passed. Life at the academy meant following 1,000 small rules. Don't start eating until everybody at the cafeteria table is seated. Always put your paper napkin on your lap first. Always stand up when a teacher enters the room. Never chew gum when you are in uniform, even if you're just walking home. It's not how academy students conduct themselves. These 1,000 little rules became second nature to Erica, as to almost all the students. She found her diction changing, especially when she addressed strangers. She found her posture evolving, so that she adopted an almost military bearing. These little routines were almost always about self-discipline in one way or another. They were about delaying gratification or exercising some small act of self-control. She didn't really think about them this way. The rules were just the normal structure of life for a student such as herself. But they had a pervasive effect on how she lived at school, eventually at home, and even on the tennis court. By junior year, Erica wasn't quite so obsessed with tennis, but she had developed a way of mentally preparing for each match. She was using what you might call the doctrine of indirect self-control. She was manipulating small things in order to trigger the right responses about the big things. She'd sit on the bench before a match and play in her head the voices of airplane pilots she had heard, mostly in the movies. They always had such a deliberately calm manner as they came over the intercom. It put her in the right frame of mind. Then she would go through certain tricks and habits, match after match. Always lay your water bottles in the same spot near the net. Always put your racket cover under your chair with the same side facing up. Always wear the same mismatched sweatbands on your wrist. Always step over the lines on the way onto the court. Always draw a line with the right sneaker at the spot from which you will do your serving. Always think about serving 5 aces in a row. If you don't actually feel you're going to serve aces, just pretend. If your body impersonates an attitude long enough, then the mind begins to adopt it. Once on the court, Erica had strict rules for herself. There were 2 locales in her universe, on the court and off the court. Off the court is for thinking about the past and future. On the court is for thinking about the present. When Erica was about to serve, she thought about 3 things: spin, location, and velocity. If she found herself thinking about something else, she would step back, bounce the ball a few times, and then resume. Erica would not allow herself to have a conception of her opponent. She would not allow herself to think about line calls. Her performance would be judged by how the ball left her racket, and nothing else was within her control. Her own personality was not at the center. Her talent wasn't at the center. Her ego and self-worth were not at the center. The task was at the center. By putting the task at the center, Erica could quiet the conscious self. She could direct her attention away from her own qualities, her expectations, her nerve, her reputation, and she could lose herself in the game. She could prevent herself from thinking too much, which is death to peak performance. She could merge with the patterns of the craft. She could fall back on the many hours of practice when she had done the same thing over and over and laid down certain models in her mind. And when she did this, her self-control was just outstanding, and nothing could ruffle her. When playing a game like tennis or baseball or soccer, athletes' brains are engaged in complicated cycles of perception, reperception, and correction. Research by Claudio Del Percio of Sapienza University in Rome has found that, while engaging in difficult tasks, star athletes' brains are actually quieter than non-athletes' brains. They have prepared their minds to perform these sorts of tasks, so it takes much less mental labor to excel. They also see what is happening much more clearly. Salvatore Agliotti, also of Sapienza, assembled a group of basketball and non-basketball players to watch movies of free throws. The movies stopped just after the ball was released from the hand, and the athletes had to guess if the ball went in the basket. The basketball players were much better at this. They did it by activating the parts of their brains that control hand and muscle motion. They reenacted the free throw and felt it as if they themselves were performing the task. In short, expert players experience sports differently than non-experts. 95% of the time, Erica's regimen worked. She worried less her junior year, and she played better. There were occasions, though, when her composure slipped. She felt the demon of her anger slipping the chain and about to go off on a romp. She had a ritual for this, too. She would think about her anger and she would say to herself, "That is not who I am. That is an experience that is happening within me." She imagined a grassy field. On one side was the angry dog of her anger, but on the other was the tennis player who had won her last 5 matches. She would imagine herself wandering away from the dog and over to the tennis player. She was trying to establish the right distance between herself and the world. She was practicing the form of self-monitoring that Daniel J. Siegel calls mind-sight. She was reminding herself that she had a say in triggering which inner self would dominate her behavior. All she had to do was focus her attention on one internal character rather than another. This wasn't easy. Sometimes the act of focusing attention required an immense display of mental force. but it was doable. William James was among the first to understand the stakes involved in these sorts of decisions. The whole drama of voluntary life hinges on the amount of attention, slightly more or slightly less, which rival motor ideas might receive. Effort of attention is thus the essential phenomenon of the will. Those who have habits and strategies to control their attention can control their lives. As Erica aged, she got better at shifting attention from one impulse to another and triggering different models in her head. The orchid seemed more likely to bloom. Inspiration. After a few years in the academy, she was different. The downside was that she was now somewhat estranged from her old neighborhood friends and even from her parents. They thought she'd entered a cult. The good news was that she had discovered how to work. One day, a middle-aged Hispanic woman visited the academy. This woman had started a restaurant company and now owned a chain of restaurants spread around the country. She was thin, well-dressed in a conservative business suit, and extremely calm. Erica was transfixed. She could imagine a path between the current life she was leading now and the sort of elevated life the woman was leading. After all, that woman had traveled that path. Erica was suddenly consumed by a burning desire to be a business leader. In a short time, she went from a normal, hard-working academy student to a member of the club of the extremely ambitious. She bought an organizer book and portioned her day into color-coded blocks. She gradually changed her wardrobe. Her clothing was so prim, precise, and neat, she began to look like a ghetto Doris Day. She somehow got hold of a used desk set and divided her assignments into an in-box and an out-box. It was as though her entire being had been suddenly occupied by the ethos of Switzerland. She was meticulous, disciplined, and ready to rise. Something had lit the furnace of the little engine of ambition, which from this day forth would know no rest. Chapter 9. Culture. Researchers have spent many years exploring the jungles of the human mind in search of the source of ambition. They found some traits that highly driven people tend to share, and Erica had many of them. Ultra-driven people are often plagued by a deep sense of existential danger. Historians have long noticed that an astonishing percentage of the greatest writers, musicians, artists, and leaders had a parent die or abandon them while they were between the ages of 9 and 15. The list includes Washington, Jefferson, Hamilton, Lincoln, Hitler, Gandhi, and Stalin, just to name a few. Erica hadn't lost a parent, but her mother disappeared psychologically from time to time, and her father did physically. Like so many other ambitious people, she was haunted by the knowledge that life is precarious. Unless she scrambled to secure some spot in the world, everything could be destroyed by a sudden blow. Highly ambitious people often have met someone like themselves who achieved great success. It could be a person from their town, from their ethnic background, or with some other connection, who showed the way and fired their sense of possibility. It's amazing how little it takes to spark the imitation instinct. A few years ago, two researchers, Jeff Cohn and Greg Walton, gave Yale students a short biography of a man named Nathan Jackson, who had become a successful mathematician. But they altered one key detail in some of the biographies. In half the cases, the researchers made sure Jackson's birthday matched that of the student who was reading the bio. Then Cohen and Walton gave all the students some math problems to solve. The students who had read the essays with the matching birthdays worked on the problems 65% longer than the students without the matching birthdays. These students felt a sudden sense of kinship with Jackson and were motivated to imitate his success. Highly ambitious people often possess some early talent that gave them some sense of distinction. It didn't have to be a huge talent. Maybe they were among the better speakers in their fifth grade class, Maybe they were among the best mathematicians in their small town. But it was enough so that the achievement became a kernel of their identity. Ambitious people often have a vision of an elevated circle they might join. There's a common prejudice that ambitious people are driven to surpass their fellows, to be better than everybody else. In fact, most ambitious people are driven to achieve membership in some exclusive group or club. Erica had met the Hispanic restaurant owner at the academy, and that encounter opened up a conviction that anything was possible for her. She would go to the newsstand and buy copies of Fast Company, Wired, and Bloomberg Business Week. She imagined herself working at a small new company, part of a band of brothers working together for a common cause. She'd clip ads from other magazines showing people at parties in Manhattan or gathering at a home in Santa Monica or Saint-Tropez. She'd tape them to the walls around her room. They became the shimmering subjects of her longing, the places she would someday belong. Erica's teachers praised her for being a hard worker, for being efficient and meticulous. She began to think of herself as a person who could get things done. In 1997, Gary McPherson studied 157 randomly selected children as they picked out and learned a musical instrument. Some went on to become fine musicians, and some faltered. McPherson searched for the traits that separated those who progressed from those who did not. IQ was not a good predictor. Neither were oral sensitivity, math skills, income, or a sense of rhythm. The best single predictor was a question McPherson had asked the students before they had even selected their instruments. How long do you think you will play? The students who planned to play for a short time did not become very proficient. The children who planned to play for a few years had modest success. But there were some children who said, in effect, "I want to be a musician. I'm going to play my whole life." Those children soared. The sense of identity that children brought to the first lesson was the spark that would set off all the improvement that would subsequently happen. It was a vision of their future self. Work. Some people live in romantic ages. They tend to believe that genius is the product of a divine spark. They believe that there have been, throughout the ages, certain paragons of greatness, Dante, Mozart, Einstein, whose talents far exceeded normal comprehension, who had an otherworldly access to transcendent truth, and who are best approached with reverential awe. We, of course, live in a scientific age. Vast amounts of research have now been conducted on early achievement and collected in volumes like The Cambridge Handbook of Expertise and Expert Performance. The prevailing view is that geniuses are largely built, not born. In the flinty and overly prosaic view that is now dominant, even Mozart's early abilities were not the product of some supernatural gift. His early compositions were not acts of genius, researchers argue. Mozart was a very good musician at an early age, but he would not stand out among today's top child performers. What Mozart had, it's maintained, was the same thing many extraordinarily precocious performers have: a lot of innate ability, the ability to focus for long periods of time, and an adult intent on improving one's skills. Mozart played a lot of piano at a very young age, so he got his 10,000 hours of practice in early, and then he built from there. The latest research suggests a prosaic, democratic, even puritanical view of how fantastic success is achieved. The key factor separating geniuses from the merely accomplished is not a divine spark. Instead, what really matters is the ability to get better and better gradually over time. As K. Anders Ericsson of Florida State University has demonstrated, it's deliberate practice. Top performers spend more hours, many more hours, rigorously honing their craft. As Ericsson has noted, top performers devote 5 times more hours to become great than the average performers devote to become competent. John Hayes of Carnegie Mellon studied 500 masterworks of classical music. Only three of them were published within the first 10 years of the composer's career. For all the rest, it took a decade of solid, steady work before they could create something magnificent. The same general rule applies to Einstein, Picasso, T.S. Eliot, Freud, and Martha Graham. It's not just the hours, it's the kind of work done in those hours. Mediocre performers practice in the most pleasant way possible. Great achievers practice in the most deliberate and self-critical way. Often they break their craft down to its smallest constituent parts, and then they work on one tiny piece of the activity over and over again. At the Meadowmount Music Camp, students spend 3 hours covering one page of music. They play the music 5 times more slowly than normal. If somebody nearby can hear the music and recognize the tune, they are not playing slowly enough. At the Spartak Tennis Club, students have rallies without a ball. They simply work on pieces of their technique. Benjamin Franklin taught himself to write in the following manner. He would read an essay in The Spectator, the best-written magazine of his day. He would write notes on each sentence of the essay on a separate piece of paper. Then he would scramble the notes and return to them after a few weeks. Then he would try to organize the notes in the proper order and use them to recreate the original essay. This is how he taught himself structure. When he discovered that his vocabulary lagged behind the original Spectator authors, he switched to another technique. He would translate each essay, sentence by sentence, into poetry. Then, a few weeks later, he would try to reconvert the poetry back into prose. As Daniel Coyle notes in his book, The Talent Code, every skill is a form of memory. It takes hard work and struggle to lay down those internal structures. In this way, brain research reinforces the old-fashioned work ethic. Execution. Schoolwork structured Erica's life during her high school years. It was the activation of some inner nature. She didn't have one great teacher who changed her life. Instead, the academy's atmosphere subtly inculcated certain habits of order, discipline, and regularity. Erica loved organizing her assignment book. She loved making checklists and checking off each task as she finished it. If, by high school graduation, you had asked her to list one outstanding trait she possessed, she would have said, "I am an organized person." She had a desperate need to get things right. In this way, she was drawn to the world of business. Successful people tend to find those milieus where the gifts they possess are most highly valued. We can all point to charismatic business leaders who lead like heroes on horseback. But most business leaders are not of that sort. Most are the sort of calm, disciplined, determined leaders Erica wanted to be. In 2009, Stephen Kaplan, Mark Klebanoff, and Morten Sorensen completed a study called Which CEO Characteristics and Abilities Matter? They relied on detailed personality assessments of 316 CEOs and measured their company's performances. There is no one personality style that leads to corporate or any other kind of success, but they found that the traits that correlated most powerfully with success were attention to detail, persistence, efficiency, analytical thoroughness, and the ability to work long hours. That is to say, the ability to organize and execute. These results are consistent with a lot of work that's been done over the past few decades. In 2001, Jim Collins published a best-selling study called Good to Great. He found that many of the best CEOs were not flamboyant visionaries. They were humble, self-effacing, diligent, and resolute souls who found one thing they were really good at and did it over and over again. They did not spend a lot of time on internal motivational campaigns. They demanded discipline and efficiency. That same year, Murray Barrick, Michael Mount, and Timothy Judge surveyed a century's worth of research into business leadership. They too found that extroversion, agreeableness, and openness to new experience did not correlate well with CEO success. Instead, what mattered was emotional stability and conscientiousness, being dependable, making plans, and following through. These sorts of dogged but diffident traits do not correlate well with education levels. CEOs with law or MBA degrees do not perform better than CEOs with college degrees.
These traits do not correlate with salary or compensation packages, nor do they correlate with fame and recognition.
On the contrary, a study by Ulrika Malmendier and Jeffrey Tate found that CEOs get less effective as they become more famous and receive more awards. Erica didn't dream of becoming flashy and glamorous. She hungered for control. She prized persistence, order, attention to detail.